Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
This will certainly have an adult theme and might well contain strong scenes of sex or violence, which could be quite graphic. It may also contain some very explicit language, which will frequently mean sexual swear words.
What do you like listening to?
Chart music.
Chart music.
Thursday night. It's about 90 minutes past the 7. It's March the 4th, 1993. And this episode of Top of the Pops. It's alright, you know, I'm a bit shocked by how not catchy it is. Anyway, Pop Craze youngsters, welcome to the final part of episode 73 of Chart Music. I'm Al Needham, they're Simon Price and Sarah B, you're you, and this is Top of the Fucking Pops. So let's tuck in.
Here we go with this week's Top 40 Breakers. Climbing at number 25, Rage Against the Machine, Killing in the Name. Draw the scene that burns rises!
We go straight from Run Rig to the Sting for the Breakers section without even bothering to go back to Frankly. He's getting fuck all airtime in this episode, isn't he?
Yeah, Basically a glorified voiceover artist.
First up, it's Killing in the Name by Rage Against the Machine. Formed in Los Angeles in 1991, Rage Against the Machine got their name from a song that front person Zach De La Rocca wrote for his old band, Inside Out. In December of 1991, after garnering a following on the LA gig circuit, they recorded a 12-track demo tape, which they started selling at gigs, with a cover consisting of newspaper stock exchange figures with an actual match affixed to it. And after they sold over 5,000 copies of it, they started shopping it around to record labels. One label, Atlantic, was so taken by it that one of the staff bootlegged it and sold hundreds of copies of it under a different cover, which led the band to reject their overtures and sign to Epic instead. This single, their debut, is the lead-off track from their first LP, Rage Against the Machine, which came out last November, which already caused heads to snap back in the record shop due to its cover, which featured the Vietnamese monk Thich Quang Duc, who set himself on fire in protest at the persecution of Buddhists in South Vietnam in the early 60s. It crashed into the chart last week at number 27, and this week, after an incident that we may discuss later on, it's nudged up two places to number 25. And here's a very selective clip of the video, which was directed by Peter Gideon, one of Tom Morello's guitar students, who filmed the band having fun on stage at the Whiskey A Go-Go and the Club With No Name. And panel, this is why I was so down on Lenny Kravitz earlier, because I knew this was coming. Fucking hell, I love this song.
Fuck. Yeah, I knew it was coming. And still, when it came on, when I was watching the episode, I went, fuck, my diaphragm just twanged a little bit. It's like there's a set of muscles. This is actually scientifically proven. There's a set of muscles in the neck and jaw that can only be activated by this record. It's like a natural reflex. You know, like when the doctor hits your knee with his toffee hammer.
I mean, we only get 23 seconds of it, possibly because the BBC have had their fingers burned, chopped off, put in a microwave for 3 hours, and then lobbed down an active volcano over this single. Let's get to it now. Article in the news section of this week's NME. Rage Against the Machine, who were forced to cancel the last 3 dates of their UK tour due to illness last week, are at the centre of 2 censorship rows. The row started after Radio 1 received 138 phone complaints after broadcasting the band's current single, Killing in the Name, unedited during last Sunday's Top 40 chart show. DJ Bruno Brooks played the original version of the single, culminating in the line, "Fuck you, I won't do what you tell me," repeated 16 times. A spokeswoman for Radio 1 said a studio mix-up meant the obscene version was played instead of the edited clean version. "We apologise to everyone who phoned up to complain," she said.
Amazing.
"It was an unfortunate mistake. These things happen." 2 days after the furore, BBC Two's The Late Show censored the band's live version of Bullet in the Head on Tuesday's No Nirvana Grunge special, which repeated the word motherfucker. Disgusting! And it's also worth noting that not only have the supposedly down with the kids NME have censored all the swear words themselves, but they've also written motherfucker. Fucker. You know, like newsreaders of the Aventis used to say, skinheads.
Yeah.
Yeah, the story goes that Brooks had put the record on without checking and slipped off to record a promo or something. Came back absolutely unaware that he'd laid 16 fucks upon the nation. And apparently was suspended for a week. So there we go. Rage Against the Machine have done nothing else. They've got rid of Bruno Brooks for a week.
But, amazing.
You know, this is one thing that always does my head in about DJs. You know, you'd see them on things like Nationwide presenting the shows. And the minute they put a record on and it starts playing, they take the fucking headphones and start blathering on or pissing about, not checking what they're actually playing.
Yeah.
That's insane, man. I mean, I could never do that. I'd be listening all the time in case I put the wrong record on, or worse, because I don't know if I even want to mention this. I've had this massive phobia since the mid-80s about getting a load of mates round to watch a video. And as I put it in and it started up, I'd immediately think to myself, you know what? What if this isn't Spinal Tap or Driller Killer and it's actually a video of me sat in my armchair having a massive wank with a big gormless smile on my face? Just to clarify, Paul Craig Youngster, I have never, ever made or owned a tape of myself having a massive wank and not holding my mouth right. But
yeah, but AI will take care of that. Yeah.
God, yeah.
Deep fakes. Yeah.
I didn't think about that. And that fear is lingering for the, you know, even nowadays, you know, what usually happens is we pick out what Top of the Pops we're going to do and I send you the video. The minute I press the send button, I think, you know, what if this isn't Top of the Pops but me unattractively availing myself of my own facilities? All I'm saying is if Bruno Brooks has been as paranoid as me, he wouldn't have got himself into this shit.
Yeah, I actually DJed on the BBC about 15 times a few years ago. Yeah, I was on BBC Radio Sussex, and I was a guest presenter on BBC Introducing quite a few times. And there was a track I was playing that I knew had a fuck on it. And I sat there hovering over the mute button because I knew when it was coming. Yeah. I didn't have the skills to actually do my own edit of the song. So I had to do it live, like fucking just hit that button for a split second to bleep out the fuck, and I did it. So that's professionalism, Bruno Brooks. That is professionalism.
Yeah. But anyway, again, with the early 70s riffage, fucking hell.
Yeah. Rage Against the Machine are the other band on this episode where I got there first.
Ooh.
And I can't claim any special credit for that because it's not like they were some obscure indie band playing in pubs. They were already signed to Sony, well, you know, Epic, but they had the Sony machine behind them.
Yeah.
But what happened was, the previous year, in 92, promos of this song had started circulating a long, long time before even the album had come out. And one of them reached me, and one of them reached two DJs called Jonathan and Eco, who ran a night called Feet First at the Camden Palace, which was a legendary Tuesday night indie night for students. That was like, it was either a quid to get in, or sometimes it was free if you had the right kind of flyer. And, you know, it's a bit of a legendary place. I saw Jane's Addiction there. I saw Suede. I saw Ride. Daisy Chainsaw, all kinds of bands that became a big deal just for free at that club. But Jonathan and Nico started playing Killing in the Name by Rage Against the Machine months before anybody knew who Rage Against the Machine were. And the crowd used to go absolutely fucking mental for it. And people got coming up and go, what's that song? What's that song?
Yeah.
That's actually quite impressive, because indie nightclub crowds can be very conservative. They basically wanted to hear Size of a Cow by The Wonder Stuff or The Only Living Boy in New Cross by Carter the Unstoppable Sex Machine over and over and over. Or if they're being really daring, they would leap about to Out of Space by The Prodigy. So for this kind of funk metal, this angry funk metal political epic, to get dropped in the middle of a primetime DJ set week after week and for people to go fucking nuts to it tells you something about what kind of song it is and what it was. And it had the same effect on me, you know. Even though it was on a major label, I did have to pull a few strings and do a bit of digging to find out, well, you know, how do I get hold of these fuckers? When are they coming over? And I ended up interviewing them in the dressing room of the Camden Underworld,
right?
Which is where, you know, that's the level they were at the time, to write what turned out to be their first UK interview.
Ooh.
I've got them, I've got I've got Rage Against the Machine, I've got Suede, I've got The Darkness, and Wu-Tang Clan, who in various ways I can claim as my personal firsts. But yeah, I thought this record was just fucking superb, and it's been done to death now, and it's become the stuff of mockery for various reasons, which I'm sure we'll come to. But if you just try and wipe all that away and just imagine the visceral feeling of hearing this for the first time, and as Sarah says, just what it does to your body involuntarily, it's extraordinary. It's just a very, very exciting piece of music. And yeah, there was kind of a lot of this sort of thing about. I already mentioned Jane's Addiction, but in terms of funk rock or funk metal, we'd had Red Hot Chili Peppers, we'd had Faith No More. There were sort of crossover things, collaboration things. So you had Public Enemy with Anthrax, and you had Ice-T with his band Body Count, and things like the Beatniks and stuff like that. So there's a lot of that stuff going around, but Rage Against the Machine really fucking carried it off. They actually, probably more than anyone other than Public Enemy in their collaboration with Anthrax, managed to harness the excitement of rap and metal at the same time in a way that it became horribly influential, of course. And it does mean that the refrain, "Fuck you, I won't do what you tell me," has gone from being a kind of critique of the American military-industrial complex to basically adolescent petulance. And essentially, it gave birth to all those Papa Roach-type bands. Whose main message was really, fuck you, Mom, I won't tidy my bedroom. That's what it gave us. But it's not. That's not Rage Against the Machine's fault. They can't help that. And this single, and also Bullet in the Head and Bomb Track, were just astonishing. And the things that Tom Morello does with his guitar, it doesn't sound like a guitar. It sounds like some kind of industrial vinyl scratching, or God knows what he's doing there.
Yeah, because there's been so many attempts to make Walk This Way by Run DMC happen again, and most of them have been absolute cat shit. But this lot here, they've cracked it by simply having a lead singer who shouts and someone who can kind of make his guitar scratch, and he sounds fucking brilliant.
Well, he's a nerd, Tom Morello. He's a fucking guitar nerd. And sometimes, in fact, I would say 9 times out of 10, that leads nowhere good. But every now and then you get someone like him who has this incredible grasp of technique and does something kind of awesome with it, you know.
And again, from a British perspective, here's another example of a trend that started to kick in the early 90s. Because, you know, if we as British kids were worked up into a froth about the idea of America in the 70s and then were crushed under the weight of American cultural juggernauts in the 80s, the 90s, or at least the early part of it, was all about being told by Americans that America was just as shit as our country. This was the decade when the curtain was pulled back to reveal people from trailer parks fighting with each other on Jerry Springer. And it's like, oh, America's actually not all that after all. Grunge told us that, hip-hop told us that, and here's another example.
You've got Zach De La Rocha basically saying that there is significant crossover between the US military and the KKK.
And the police.
Some of those who burn crosses are the same that join forces. Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
And also, you know, the idea of an American rock band who were properly left-wing, that was a fucking mind blast in 1993.
Yeah, it was. You know, you either had American rock bands who were kind of bozos politically or just didn't really care, they weren't engaged politically, but they could rock. Mm. Or you had hip-hop acts who did know where it's at politically, but weren't really interested in rock. So to have the two together was unexpected. Yeah, definitely.
Yeah.
They were really smart as well, Rage Against the Machine. They were prone to sloganeering, and fuck you, I won't do what you tell me is nothing if not a very basic and direct slogan. But they knew what they were doing. They knew that's how rock works. That's how you reach people. Mm. You're not really going to reach people with impenetrable Marxist dialectic. You have to boil it down to a slogan. Tom Morello was really fucking smart. He had an honours degree in political science from Harvard, which, you know, nobody expects that from a fucking guitarist in an American rock band. Did you see that thing that happened on Twitter in 2018 about this?
No.
This was so funny. This is the best own I've seen on the internet. So he posted a photo of his guitar with Fuck Trump painted on it.
Yeah.
And some Burke wrote, another successful musician instantly becomes a political expert, right? So Morello's reply was amazing, right? He said, one does not have to be an honours grad in political science from Harvard University to recognise the unethical and inhumane nature of this administration. But, well, I happen to be an honours grad in political science from Harvard University, so I can confirm that for you. It's fucking brilliant.
Nice. See, I think that this is actually piss-take proof. Mm. I think it is bulletproof because it's so serious. Mm. Zach De La Rocha is a serious man, a serious activist who really cares and really, you know, that's what he is first, almost before a musician, you know. And I don't think any amount of recontextualizing or overexposure can really tarnish it.
Yeah.
It's also another track that is very interesting in terms of what perspective it's written from. It kind of zooms in and out. There's a kind of philosophical abstract perspective, and then there's a kind of crash zoom to an accusation. Now you do what they told you. Now you're under control. So it's very urgent, but it's almost mocking, poking at you, and you know.
Yeah.
And so there's these kind of dizzying shifts in perspective.
Mm.
I think at the end as well with the coda, it's like it's not just Zach speaking, it's a sort of radical ventriloquism where it's like I'm speaking for you now.
Yeah,
it's like, and it's irresistible. It's like his voice just becomes this kind of disembodied chant.
Yeah,
and you know who it belongs to, but it's taken on a life of its own. And he starts quietly and gets louder and louder, like he's awakening to how things really are. You know. Also, it's. I don't know about you, how long do you think the final motherfucker is in there? Just off the top of your head. In your head, how long do you think it is?
8 seconds.
I'd say about 8 seconds.
Right. It isn't at all. It's really short because like, the final fuck you, I won't do what you tell me is very emphatic and you can hear the full stop and the kind of mic drop. And the motherfucker after it is just like an extra shoe in the ribs.
Mm.
But it's very short. You just remember it as a long scream in your head because that's what everyone does. Everyone just goes, motherfucker!
Yeah.
But what it actually is motherfucker!
Right.
Yes.
It's short. It's really short. It's so funny like how it actually becomes something else because it, hey man, it belongs to the people. I mean, it truly is the alt-rock Come On Eileen.
Yes.
Drop it at a wedding.
Yes, it is.
See
well
that
said.
Dance floor go off.
Yes.
That and Chop Suey by System of a Down. Those are the two, yeah.
Right.
I did start to think, I was trying to compose a list of, you know, songs that speed up and slow down, which is a risky gambit, but, you know, if you can pull it off, it will get people fucking going.
Oh, right, yeah. It does that.
Yeah. I mean, because Lil Louis did the opposite.
Oh, yeah.
And slowed it down, and that was audacious as well as salacious.
Mm.
But there's not very many. There's also my favourite piece of classical music and also the only one that I can name. Is In the Hall of the Mountain King by Grieg.
Right.
And that's, you know the one? And that speeds up a little bit towards the end. Some versions of it, they really go all out, and which kind of misses the point. You only need to do it a little bit. And another extremely overexposed, decontextualized piece of music that is used, it's editors love it, just that slap it over a montage of just some chaos happening in a reality show. It's just like oral shorthand for chaos, hedonism, or general semi-scripted skullfuckery. But it doesn't matter to me. Like, every time I hear that, I go, oh, and I get this tingle of, like, I don't know what it is. It's just like, oh, my God. Da, 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 da. Yeah. It's like being captured by trolls and borne aloft down the mountain by such. And I realise that it hasn't, in real terms, it has not been preserved with its original meaning, and it lost that a long time ago. And it's grim to think about the state of America now, which is terrifying and depressing. And, you know, there's 30 years later. And I think the some of the right wing did try to claim this for themselves, didn't they, before they realised what it was actually about. It's that kind of knee-jerk, oppositional defiant disorder, which is just kind of running rampant among public life in America now.
Yeah.
When this record first came out, you could be confident if you suffered a miscarriage, you could get medical help and not have to stagger bleeding from one hospital to the next to find a doctor who wasn't afraid of being accused of baby murder.
Yeah.
So it's there's something really bleak about it. It's like, I just imagine Wall-E doing his round after humanity has left the trash planet and finding a little tape deck with this in it, you know.
But this song, man, it's the soundtrack to one of my most cherished memories.
You sure you want to tell us this?
6 months after this episode, I suddenly find myself in Ludlow in Shropshire.
Good start, okay.
As the staff writer of a new Mega Drive magazine. Got the job straight from graduating.
Nice.
From an advert in The Guardian. And I'm fucking loving it, man. I'm practically running to work. I'm hammering out page after page of copy in a converted mill with a mixture of media professionals poached from other mags and farm lads who could write. And those farm lads, fucking hell, their idea of a good night out was getting into a field, getting some weed or some pig tranquilizers or sniff some silage, a bottle of Mad Dog 2020 and listen on a tape deck to Rage Against the Machine, Black Sun by Cypress Hill and the Judgment Night soundtrack.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, or they will fucking bang into that.
Yeah, Judgment Night, that was the whole gimmick, wasn't it? Yeah. It was like hip-hop act juxtaposed with rock act all the way through. Sorry, carry on, yeah.
So, anyway, it's the Christmas do in the local theatre, and I end up sitting at a table with the owners of the company called Roger and Ollie Frey, and their history was fascinating. They were practically run out of London by the Met in the late 70s because they published a gay magazine called Zipper. And they ended up in Shropshire, and they started doing catalogues in the early 80s for ZX81 games, realised no one was doing any actual games mags, and they started up Crash and Zap, which, you know, if you were that way inclined, monuments of the 80s, and both of them fucking love me. So we end up at this table chatting about my future plans and everything, and I'm sitting there realising, fucking hell, they're talking about fast-tracking me right up the ladder, and I'm looking at being an editor by the end of next year. So I'm leaning in hard to hear what they're saying. And then some of the farm lads who've been pestering the DJ to stop playing all this Christmas party shit and put some proper music on, one of them's just run back from his house with Black Sunday and Rage Against the Machine and told him to put that on. And they play Killing in the Name.
Yeah.
While all this serious discussion about my career's going on, I notice out the corner of the eye that like five of my mates, Miles, who was a greb lad with hair down to his arse and about 50 bangles up his arm, my mate, the accessible games dog, who I ended up living with, a chap called Pricer, who was essentially Kurt Cobain but with more Lynx Nevada, a Welsh goth called Will, who was pretty much the world's first emo, may he rest, and Johnny Sex Cat, had all climbed up on the stage and were going absolutely fucking psychobillies at a Meteors gig on each other to Killing in the Name. And I'm watching this out the corner of my eye. I fight so hard not to howl with laughter at it. I end up blowing an actual snot bubble in front of my paymasters.
Oh, ow.
It didn't really matter in the end because the night ended with everyone getting pissed up and Ollie absolutely off his box with his shirt completely undone, grabbing the mic off the DJ and screaming, "Everyone, dance! Dance for your magazines." And in 6 weeks' time, the entire company would fold.
Oh, shit.
Because the financial director had embezzled £500,000 out of the company. So, yeah.
Oh, well, the snot bubble didn't matter that much then. That's all right.
No, it didn't.
Yeah. I've DJed to that demographic myself. I went to Baskerville Hall, which is in Hay-on-Wye, which is just inside Wales, but basically it's next to Herefordshire. Yorkshire, which is not far from Shropshire, obviously. Mm. And Baskerville Hall had this massive kind of barn. It's like a disco attached to it. And yeah, it is that Baskerville Hall, by the way, as in, you know, Conan Doyle. I was DJing for a mate's wedding down there. And I was just playing stuff like Daft Punk or whatever, because it was that sort of era, and it went fine. But that crowd, they are fucking hardcore, that's for sure, right? Mm. And hearing what you're telling me now, I should have played Rage Against the Machine just to see the reaction.
Oh, they would have fucking gone off, mate.
The name, of course, Rage Against the Machine, lent itself to all kinds of fun. Mm. So David Stubbs, when writing the comedy pages of Melody Maker TTT, used to have a section every week for quite a long time of every week, Rage Against the Machine, Rage Against a Machine. Zach De La Rocha just really swearing about a fucking fax machine or a washing machine or whatever it may be. And of course, I'm pretty sure that we had Glastonbury coverage at one point with a headline, Rage Against the Latrine.
It did gladden my heart slightly last year or the year before to see how deeply embedded this track is in the culture in America, and in a good way. Mm. Al, you know the Herman Cain Awards, subreddit, it's slightly distastefully.
Oh, God, yes.
People were very defiant about COVID and wouldn't wear masks and all this kind of thing, and made a big deal of it on their social media. Oh, yeah. It's assembling their life and death in their memes and posts, and inevitably the last ones being, I think I'm feeling better, and then here's a GoFundMe for the funeral. But one of these posted a meme that was George Carlin quote, "Never underestimate the power of stupid people in large groups," referring to, you know, all the sheep following the rules about COVID. And some brilliant wag underneath said, "Some of those that quote Carlin are the same that win Darwin."
Oh! Yeah, nice.
Very good.
Nice.
So the following week, Killing in the Name dropped 12 places to number 35. The follow-up, Bullet in the Head, did even better, getting to number 16 in May, and they'd round off the year with Bomb Track getting to number 37 in September. They went on to notch up three more top 40 hits over the rest of the decade, including getting to number 8 with Bulls on Parade in April of 1996 and Split Up in 2000. A year later, in the wake of 9/11, Clear Channel Communications, the biggest radio station conglomerate in America, circulated a list of lyrically questionable songs that were not to be played on radio because they vaguely remind people of planes flying into buildings, with all 43 recordings made by Rage Against the Machine on the blacklist. There's a fucking achievement. Would you care, chaps, to hear a selection of the other tunes on that list?
Yes, please.
Okay, so another one, Bites the Dust and Killer Queen by Queen.
Right.
It's the End of the World as We Know It by REM. Mm. Jump by Van Halen.
Oh, fucking hell, right. I know. Okay.
Great Balls of Fire by Jerry Lee Lewis.
Right.
Break Stuff by Limp Bizkit. Ruby Tuesday by the Rolling Stones.
What?
Yeah, 9/11 happened on a Tuesday, you see.
What?
I know. Yeah, right. So I'm guessing Everything's Tuesday by Chairman of the Board was on that list as well. Benny and the Jets, Rocket Man and Daniel by Elton John.
Why Daniel?
He's flying away, isn't he?
Oh, I suppose, yeah.
Fly Away by Lenny Kravitz.
Sorry, Lenny.
Yeah. Imagine by John Lennon. Yes, about fucking time.
Yeah, Imagine, which is actually against religious indoctrination. So,
Dancing in the Street by Martha and the Vandellas.
What, because people in certain parts of the world were literally dancing in the street at the sight of the towers coming down?
But not Dancing in the Street by Bowie and Jagger. Fucking hell, as if people had suffered enough.
Yeah, but why was the Vandellas one? But I just don't get it.
Racism.
Yeah.
99 Red Balloons by Nana.
Right.
St. Elmo's Fire by John Parr. What a Wonderful World by Louis Armstrong.
Fair enough.
The Night Chicago Died by Paper Lace. Okay. And Bits and Pieces by the Dave Clark Five. Yeah. But then, in early December of 2008, the DJ John Mortar was so appalled at the Christmas number one race being ruined by the X Factor that he launched a social media campaign to run a designated spoiler. Unfortunately, his choice of single that year, Never Gonna Give You Up by Rick Astley, only became that year's Christmas number 73. But a year later, possibly inspired by a news story about an Asda in Preston getting into trouble by playing Killing in the Name the previous year. He tried again, and Killing in the Name entered the chart at number 8 the week before Christmas. After being invited to perform the song live on the Radio 5 breakfast show on the condition that they cut the swearing out and then not doing what the BBC told them, leading to Nicky Campbell and Sheila Fogarty having to apologise,
you know,
the single soared 79 places to number 1.
Whoa, that's the biggest soar you've ever done.
Fucking hell. Did you hear that? Live.
No, I didn't know about it.
It was so beautiful.
I mean, what do they think's going to happen?
Well, yeah. BBC Radio 5 Live go up to them and say, yeah, you know that song where you say you won't do what we tell you? Can you do it? But in this case, can you do what we tell you? There's a live clip of it on YouTube. And at the beginning, he refrains from the fuck you, but he just builds up and then he just goes into it. And your fist... both your fists and your feet go up in the air. Yes! And I've got to say, man, that night when it got to number one, it did feel like a moment.
Yeah, I think that was brilliant. It was a perfect deployment of American sincerity in the service of British absurdism. It was great.
Yes.
I don't think it diminished it at all. It was fantastic.
I think at the time I didn't like it because I got the hatred of Simon Cowell and X Factor and all of that, sure. But I just thought the way to beat bad pop is with good pop, not to beat it with proper real rock music, you know, by real musicians. And I felt that's what was going on. I felt like, but I've kind of mellowed about it now, and I'm glad that Ratum, R-A-T-M, however you say it. Do we say Ratum? No one ever says that. I'm glad Rage Against the Machine have a number one to their name.
It seems only right and righteous.
They're always going to be there, man. That's it now.
Yeah.
Christmas number ones.
Yeah.
Which now mean less and less.
Yeah.
You know, at a time when it still meant something, there they are forever.
It is brilliant.
And since then, the song has been used in 2012 at UKIP rallies.
Fuck
and
me.
And by a load of Trumper lumpers at a Republican Party rally in 2020. Both times, the band told them, quite rightly, to fuck off. Killing in the name of. Now you do what they told you.
He was live here last week. Great new song from Brian Ferry. New at 22, I Put a Spell on You. I put a spell
on you. Born in Washington, County Durham in 1945, Brian Ferry spent the late 60s studying fine art at Newcastle University and dabbling with local bands until he relocated to London in 1968 to teach art and pottery at Holland Park School. In 1970, he auditioned for the role of lead singer of King Crimson. And although he wasn't deemed a suitable replacement for Gordon Haskell, he so impressed Pete Sinfield that the band he went on to form, Roxy Music, was signed to Sinfield's EG record label. They put out their debut single, Virginia Plain, in August of 1972 and scampered up the charts to number 4, kicking off a career that would spawn 10 top 10 singles and a number 1 with Jealous Guy in March of 1981. However, Ferry also began a solo career almost right from the off, starting in 1973 when he put out the covers LP These Foolish Things, with the lead-off cut, a cover of Dylan's A Hard Rain's Gonna Fall, getting to number 10 in October of that year, and went on to put out 5 more solo LPs throughout the 70s. After splitting up Roxy in 1983, he resumed his solo career, racking up his first and only number one LP with Boys and Girls in 1985, knocking out 5 top 40 hits over the latter half of the decade. In 1987, he reunited with Brian Eno, however, and commenced work on his next LP. And by the time 1993 came round, it was still being worked on. However, he's taken the time to knock out Taxi, another almost all covers LP which comes out next week, and this is the lead-off single from it. It's a bash at the 1956 Screaming Jay Hawkins single, which the Alan Price set took to number 9 for 2 weeks in April of 1966, but by this point was best known for Nina Simone's cover, which got to number 28 in February of 1969. It came out last week and he was immediately hustled over to Elstree for a live performance with an all-female band, loads of candles and fishing nets, and that French dance where women get thrown about. And this week it's entered the charts at number 22, so here's a clip of the video. All 24 seconds of it. I mean, they're obviously trying to lump in as many tunes as possible and they're clearly fretting about the attention span of the Sonic and Mario crazed youth of today, but I think you get more of a feel of the song and the artist on an Al Price advert, don't you?
I'm amazed it was as much as 24 seconds. I didn't time it, but it felt more like five, you know.
Yeah. I mean, 5 years ago, a slot in the breakers section, that's going to bag to you anything from 45 seconds to a minute and a bit of airtime.
Right.
Which would be more than enough to make you either want to hear it in full or sit tight and see what's on next. But I feel this is doing no one any favours, really.
Yeah, I'm surprised it was 24 seconds, but I think it's enough in this instance.
So anyway, Brian Ferry in 1993, what's the point of him?
I used to travel by Virgin Atlantic quite a lot in the 90s. Back and forth to Los Angeles or Las Vegas to interview bands for Melody Maker. And and before takeoff, they would always show you this film, and it was clearly aimed at the passengers who turned left at the door instead of right, which I never did because I'm not Brian fucking Ferry, you know. And on that film, there was a little promotional clip for Necker Island, Richard Branson's private island resort in the British Virgin Islands, no relation.
Right.
And of course, private island resorts have got a bad rep these days due to the Jeffrey Epstein and the King of England's younger brother affair. But in those days, they were still seen as aspirational. And the soundtrack for that advert, obviously, was Roxy Music.
Yeah.
The implication being that if you were one of the passengers who turned right at the door and you wondered how wealthy you'd need to be in order to visit Necker Island, the answer was more than this. So by the early 90s, right, Brian Ferry was just this byword, this living, walking byword for affluence and luxury. That was his public image. And I guess it had been since the NME started calling him Byron Ferrari almost 2 decades earlier. In fact, there's an album that he released a year after this in 1994, which takes Ferry's international ruling class shtick to the absolute extreme. It's called Mamuna, and it's currently being reissued in a deluxe format, as if Brian Ferry Records could be anything other than deluxe. And it's overseen by friend of the show, Mark Wood. Hello, Mark.
Oh, hey, Mark.
And the list of personnel alone is absurdly lavish, right?
Really?
So it includes Brian Eno, Richard Norris out of The Grid, Phil Manzanera out of Roxy Music, Nile Rodgers, Pino Palladino, Guy Pratt, the rock auteur, who's another friend of mine. Hello, Guy. Maceo Parker, Andy Mackay out of Roxy Music, Carlene Anderson, and here's my favourite credit, Nan Kidwell, astrologer. The album was originally going to be called Horoscope. They had an in-house astrologer for the fucking album. This album, Mamuna, completely passed me by at the time. But I thought I should give it a listen as a bit of background research just regarding where Ferry was at in this era.
Yeah.
And it does that tightrope walk thing he does of staying mostly just the right side of boring while making sure that nothing much happens.
Yeah.
A couple of times it strays over the line, okay? The title track, Mamuna, involves him saying, "Oh, Mamuna, Mamuna," for 5 minutes while nothing much happens. There's another one called Gemini Moon that's the same. And to the untrained ear, it doesn't even seem to have a chord change. It's as if things like melodic churn are somehow vulgar. It all sounds very opulent, and the market value of your house rises by 5% when you play it. You know, they say you're meant to bake bread or make fresh coffee when you've got potential buyers coming around. Forget that. Stick on Mamuna by Brian Ferry. The weird thing is, it sounds like I'm sneering at it. I kind of enjoyed it. It's the ultimate in background music, but I kind of prefer that to what you actually hear in allegedly sophisticated joints these days, which is usually AI-generated Spotify techno, which when you try and Shazam it, it doesn't have an artist credit. Do you know, right. You know the sort of thing I mean? So all of this is what he was gearing up to when he recorded Taxi. And God, we used to take the piss out of Taxi at Melody Maker. Well, David Stubbs did.
Oh, David.
The idea being that Brian Ferry was secretly some kind of northern hick who thought that taxis were fancy.
Surely it should have been called limo. Maybe he just thought, I need to damp this down a little bit. Let's go taxi instead.
Or Viscount or Blue Ribbon.
Oh, I see where you're going. Yeah, nice.
Or Club.
Yeah.
Fucking hell, how many biscuits sound like Brian Ferry solo LPs? Not United, though. United wouldn't, no.
No, that wouldn't work.
United, maybe.
Oh, yeah, you. Very good. Is he knighted? He's something, isn't he? He's not the sort who would turn down an honour, let's say that. We know that. Yeah, fucking hell. So, him doing a covers album, as you say, not the first time. And I guess he was just doing an album of old standards just to clear the lungs or clear out the pipes, if you forgive that. Mm. So he could sort of gear up for an actual album of original material because he hadn't done anything for 5 years. The cast list on Taxi is very similar to that of Mamuna, with the addition of Greg Filinganis and Flaco Jimenez.
Right.
So some big names on there. But the thing with those 70s cover albums, so there's These Foolish Things, There's Another Time, Another Place, and Let's Stick Together, there seemed to be something different in the meaning of them. It was a bit more, I suppose, like Bowie's pinups, in that they are to be taken in the context of what the artist is doing around that time. So he's almost taking those old, you know, Great American Songbook standards and recontextualizing them in Roxy Music's world. There were these kind of implied inverted commas around them. For me, that makes it more exciting and more interesting than just a cynical deployment of familiar songs. So Roxy Music, to begin with, were all about artfully and gleefully deconstructing the very concept of glamour. You know, Baby Jane's in Acapulco, we are flying down to Rio, and all that, you know. But by the time of Mamuna, that glee in glamour, I think, has subsided to the blasé. He sounds jaded with the high life, like an older version of the protagonist from Bret Easton Ellis's Less Than Zero.
Yeah, now the party's over, he's so tired.
Exactly. Oh, well done. I wish I thought of that. There is something subtly attractive about that. He sounds as if he finds his own blessed boredom faintly erotic somehow. I do have, and I'm sorry to be that guy, but I have a problem with Brian Ferry being a fox hunter and being a Tory, right? Because him being a Tory is so on the nose, and it just seems to diminish everything he was originally about. Oh, you enjoy posh stuff, do you? Oh, so that means you have to be a Tory. Whereas I always thought Roxy Music stood for glamour as a permanent state of the imagination and for the democratization of fancy stuff. As long as you had the necessary imagination, you were allowed past the velvet rope. But no, it turns out he was just really literal about it. You have to actually be wealthy to experience his world. Of course, the one good thing that came from that was that amazing photo of him during a plane hijack.
Yes.
Where he could not look more unruffled by what's going on. I haven't seen that picture for a while, but in my mind, he has some kind of pink cocktail glass in his hand. If he doesn't, then it's implied. But doing this song, I'm not sure that Ferry's kind of blasé posh stick really serves the song very well.
No.
I put a spell on you. The original by Screaming Jay Hawkins from 1956 is a berserk blues ballad in a drunken waltz time.
Yeah.
And Hawkins does actually sound like some kind of deranged warlock or voodoo priest capable of putting a spell on you.
Yes.
I mean, Screaming Jay Hawkins eventually died of an aneurysm, and he sounds like he's halfway to causing that aneurysm on his recording of I Put a Spell on You.
Yeah, yeah.
Ferry, being Ferry, is more functional and precise. It's more, I put a spell check on you. We only get a few seconds of it, as you say. So my main thought during those few seconds, despite having just spoken for about 5 minutes, is he could be Brett Anderson's dad.
Definitely, yeah.
It is an achievement of sorts to take such a unique, characterful song and siphon it into this sort of lounge slop. I mean, I actually do like this kind of opulent sound that he has. It is very sort of luscious and noirish and you know, yeah, brilliant. But you could do that with anything. Like, I don't know why you would pick this to do that, to do in the nightclub style. I put a spell on you. I just I don't understand the kind of thought process behind it. I mean, yeah, obviously the Screaming Jay Hawkins original is just a mind-blowing thing to try to listen to, and you know, it's been covered by lots of people, but I think the definitive version for a lot of people is the Nina Simone
version. Yeah, yeah.
And I mean, obviously he's not trying to follow that, he's going completely the opposite direction, but it's so ragingly emotional. It is like the ultimate breakup song. And Nina Simone's version, as in most things she ever did, all things she ever did, just sounds like she's wrenching the words from her innards in such a way that it might actually put a curse on your lousy no good ass and freeze your cheating balls the next time you try to use them. It's like The Ring. It's like you hear that song and then 7 days later your knob falls off into the toilet. I just kind of can't get with this, really, and 24 seconds was enough for me, because it's like, okay, I see what you're doing. I don't really know why, but you do you, Brian.
The video is essentially an even more expensive reprise of the Top of the Pops performance that was on the previous week.
Right.
It's a bit like a really expensive and opulent cabaret night at Tony's Trattoria in Heidi Hyde. You know, they've got all the fishing nets hanging from the walls, and they've got women dressed up as Parisians and throwing each other about and all that kind of stuff. And it's like, yeah, that was all right. Why are we watching this then? What's the fucking point?
Yeah.
Haven't you made enough money, Brian?
Yeah, you've got to keep himself in smoking jackets and other smoking jackets. I don't know. I'm just trying to think, what does Brian Ferry spend his money on now that he's got, you know, the giant house and the priceless Abyssinian rugs? It's smoking jackets, just the whole rooms of them. You know, like MTV Cribs went round and people just lying on the floor crying, I can't take any more smoking jackets.
I mean, he's at the point in 1993 where a lot more artists are now. You know, they've been around for long enough that all they've got to do now is just be there. And anything they do will just get a little ripple of interest, and it'll get him in the charts, and it can just remind everyone that he's still alive, and then he can fuck off back to his big collection of smoking jackets.
Yeah.
So the following week, I put a spell on you, nipped up four places to number 18, but no further. But the LP entered the album chart at number 2 in the first week of April, denied the top spot by Songs of Faith and Devotion by Depeche Mode. The follow-up, a cover of the Shirelles' Will You Still Love Me Tomorrow, got to number 23 in June of this year, and he closed out 1993 with his cover of Elvis's The Girl of My Best Friend, only getting to number 57 in September.
Double A-side at new entry at number 12, Jesus Lizard and Nirvana, Person Over the Guilt.
Formed in Aberdeen, Washington in 1987, Nirvana a fucking Nirvana. They've just finished recording their third LP in Utero and are currently arguing with their label and themselves over the quality of the mix. But before all that, they decided to donate a track they recorded a year ago, Oh the Guilt, to the Chicago independent label Touch and Go Records, who handled many of the bands Kurt and the lads grew up on and is, sort of, the follow-up to In Bloom, which got to number 28 in December of 1992. The label put the single out as a double A-side, and the other side was offered to the Jesus Lizard, a band who were formed in Austin, Texas in 1987 and relocated to Chicago to link up with Touch and Go in 1989. Despite agonising over it looking like they were riding on the bigger band's coattails, they decided that they wanted in on this double A-side business and donated a track from their third LP, Liar, which came out last year. Unsurprisingly, it smashed into the chart this week at number 12, but very surprisingly, Stanley Appel has opted to give the lesser-known band a shine, and here's a bit of the video. So, chaps, what is going on here?
Yeah. It's quite a fun thing. Again, hats off to the editor of the Breakers here, who had to dab the cold sweat from their brow once more and find a pre-Watershed snippet from this video, which is basically just... gnarly industrial torture, I think we can say. And the lyrics as well, which are pretty horrifying.
Ooh.
Apparently, David Yao says that it's about a horrible man that he knew in Chicago who threw a woman down the stairs.
Oh, right.
So it's about that and also a little bit about the Texas Chainsaw Massacre.
Oh, lovely.
So, yeah, well, not very unlovely, in fact. But yes, puss, as in, it refers to him being a coward, as well as puss to mean mouth, as in sourpuss, as
right,
in...
Yeah.
Smacker in the puss. But like the chorus is entirely just sort of ways to say smack my bitch up. Including Plum in the Kisser, which is what's that from? What's Power Right in the Kisser?
I don't know.
That's that old American sitcom that is now held up as the example of like, you wouldn't do it like that anymore. It's quite confrontational, this song. And so well done to them for managing to find, again, the clean bit.
Yeah.
The clean 20 seconds.
Oh, yeah, Jackie Gleason, The Honeymooners.
Yeah, that's the one, yeah. You see, I really enjoyed this because it's like it's in the middle of, it doesn't sound like anything else. The closest thing, obviously, is to, it's closer to Rage than anything else. But, I mean, journalists at the time used to refer to the Jesus Lizard and Shellac, who they really, you can really hear the resemblance. But they were grouped together as Pigfuck. Which is obviously quite derogatory, but it's as descriptive as anything. It's sort of gritty.
Was that Robert Christgau's phrase, I think?
It sounds like him, I guess. But it's this sort of gritty, grotty, witty, shitty, clattery American noise rock of the time, which is now kind of very well respected and kind of held up as an influence on a lot of people.
Right.
The Jesus Lizard kind of made music to accompany your night terrors, really, and lyrics full of worms and amputations and fleshy gruesomeness,
right,
but all underpinned by a certain intellect, you know. You can see why Nirvana would be happy to stand alongside them, because it's very sort of rough and taut and spiky and kind of mildly upsetting. And a fun name, which obviously sounds faintly blasphemous and flows a bit better than Iguana Nun,
yes,
or Mediterranean House Gecko God.
There actually is such a thing as a Jesus lizard, isn't there?
There is. It's a type of basilisk that can run on water and looks hilarious while doing it, just to get out of, you know, to get out of danger and stuff. And they go up on their hind legs and go, oh my God, oh, is that a crocodile? Oh my God, oh my God, oh my God.
Turns out that Kurt Cobain always wanted Nirvana to sign to Touch and Go.
Right.
And sent them numerous copies of their first demo in 1988, but they kept knocking them back. So presumably this is him either giving a leg up to his favourite label or ticking off something on his bucket list, because, you know, he can do that nowadays. And there's possibly a bit of, here's what you could have won thrown in.
Yeah, and it's them showing that they're still in touch with the underground.
Yes.
Which was a sort of touchy subject for Nirvana, because they were always accused of being sellouts, and they were very sensitive about that kind of talk.
We've not spoken about Nirvana on Chart Music yet.
We're not really going to.
But it's safe to say that this single is not being sold on the strength of the name of the Jesus Lizard.
No, it's like, you know, in the 2014 World Cup semi-final, one of the greatest football matches of all time, that you could euphemistically say that Brazil and Germany shared 8 goals.
Yes.
It's a bit like that, isn't it? And it also reminded me of, in terms of coattails, you know, you've got Robbie Williams and his mate Jonathan Wilkes that he kept trying to foist on us. Do you remember that? Or Paul Gascoigne's mate Jimmy Five Bellies, or Alex Turner's mate Miles Kane. You do get a lot of this sort of thing. I think the Jesus Lizard are of higher quality than those, but it's just what the phenomenon reminded me of.
How much of a deal was the forthcoming release of In Utero in the Melody Maker office, Simon?
Oh, huge. Yeah,
yeah.
Everybody wondering whether it was going to be more slick than Nevermind. Of course, once we knew that Steve Albini was on board, not producing, because he doesn't like to be called a producer. You have to say Steve Albini recorded it. But yeah, you knew that it was going to go the opposite way, if anything.
Mm.
So, yeah, absolutely a huge deal when the album came out. And, of course, Everett True, our ass ed, assistant editor, was very close with Kurt and Courtney. So we had a bit of an in that way.
Mm.
And bands like the Jesus Lizard were covered a lot in the paper.
Yes.
Not just because they were mates with Nirvana, but because there was genuinely quite a large sort of faction of people at The Maker who were really, really, really into all that stuff that Sarah was just talking about. I had some crossover with that stuff. It didn't really tickle my fancy so much. I did go and see the Jesus Lizard at the
right.
garage at Highbury in Islington.
Oh, really?
And your man, David Yao, you've got to say like that.
Yao.
He was quite a dynamic performer, very physical, very visceral. He was sort of midway between Iggy Pop and Gigi Allin, that kind of thing, you know.
Jiggy Pop.
Yeah, yeah. You thought he was going to hurt himself or hurt you, you know, on stage.
Mm.
I quite like the way that he doesn't look like a rock star. He just looks like an ordinary bloke. And you know that normally when people say that, you sort of think of Cast or The Enemy or something, or those sort of sub-Oasis bands. But I don't mean in that kind of quite knowing, stylized way where people will dress like a football casual or something.
Mm.
I mean that he's genuinely not rock star-y whatsoever.
Yeah.
The closest thing I can get is the guy from Future Islands. You know, he looks like he should be running an Italian cafe in Chicago rather than singing in a band. I do quite like that. The clip that we do see from the video, it's great that Sarah's spelt out what the full video involves, because it's just all we see is one man shouting while another man does some welding, right?
Yeah.
And again, it's the second time I've mentioned Flashdance, but it made me think of fucking Flashdance.
Again, like most of the videos on this episode, it's a bit questionable. It did get banned on assorted channels, both here and in America, because, yes, it does feature the band doing a bit of welding. And by the end, you realise that they're welding someone else into an office chair.
Right, yeah.
So, yeah, you don't want kids to start doing that kind of shit.
I suppose it could only happen in the pre-internet age, because these days, if the BBC even showed a few seconds of it, it would then mean that kids go running straight to YouTube or wherever they get their videos to see the full-length thing, and that would be considered irresponsible to sort of even sort of give them that kind of click-through or that push-through.
Yeah.
But yeah, it was fairly safe that the BBC could show this, and that is literally all any British people are going to see of it.
Yeah.
To be honest with you, if I did go on MTV, it would be the sort of thing that I'd see for about 5 seconds and go, oh, yo, MTV Raps isn't on then, and flick over and go and look for some wrestling or see what tat's being sold on QVC, or if I was really lucky, there'd be a 70s German sex comedy on, because let's recall that the early 90s were a fucking golden age for Tatterlite, if you will, before Sky made everything digital and fucked it all up, man.
Yeah.
I'm sorry that I haven't got to see them live, actually, because they've reformed a couple of times, but I don't think they're going to do it again.
Oh, right.
They are the sort of thing that I would risk getting COVID for. I've been watching loads of live clips of them and just going, like, fucking hell, yeah, that's a compelling act. Really incredible rhythm section and just a guy screeching sort of gnomic phrases over. And once you can actually understand what they are, it's lyrics that would make Brett Anderson blush. Like, beneath a broken branch, face down in the grass, no mason or bricklayer, he, a trowel was in his ass.
Nice.
That does something for me. I don't know why. But yeah, he's very big on audience interaction and kind of climbing into the audience and taking all his clothes off at the, not necessarily at the same time, but you know.
Who wants to be welded into a chair tonight then?
He seems like David Yao seems like a really intelligent, interesting guy. He's really into photography and cookery and graphic design. Any interview of him with him, you just realise he has a very amusing turn of phrase. And he released a book. He's a big cat guy as well. He released a book of cat illustrations. And
David Meow.
Exactly.
Oh, sorry, I didn't trample on your joke there, did I?
No, that's fine. I've got more. Don't worry. He interviewed sadly departed celebrity cat Lil Bub for the AV Club, which is a truly delightful 4 minutes where he asks Lil Bub things like, have you ever been naked on stage? And Lil Bub supposedly replies, I'm always naked, David.
What's Lil Bub famous for?
Just, You know how they have celebrity animals these days.
Oh, right.
She had all sorts of genetic malformations and was, you know, sort of extremely cute. But the guy adopted her when nobody else wanted her. And it was just a, you know, it was a lovely story. And he made some money, but mostly gave most of the money that Lil Bub generated, he gave to charities. And so, you know, so yeah.
Oh,
it was very nice.
Bless.
Yeah. You Lil Bub, me Yow. Oh, hello. Was that an actual cat replying?
Bit
then?
Of cat content there.
Amazing.
For you.
So the following week, Puss/Oh the Guilt dropped 52 places to number 64. And Jesus Lizard's next and last chart appearance with Down was in September of 1994 when it got to number 64. Meanwhile, Nirvana's next release, Heart Shaped Box, got to number 5 in September of this year. Hats off, Stanley Appel.
Yeah.
Getting down with the kids.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Mother's Day is just around the corner, and it's time to pamper the special moms in your life. And what better way than with Osea's limited edition skincare sets featuring clean, vegan, cruelty-free products that are safe for your skin and the planet. Osea is a women-founded, women-led brand that's been making seaweed-infused products for nearly 30 years. This Mother's Day, Osea has 2 limited edition sets, perfect for gifting or keeping for yourself. Their Golden Glow body set includes 3 clinically proven bestsellers for silky, smooth, glowing skin, while the Glow and Go facial set has everything she needs to achieve spa-level results at home. They're so beautiful, you can skip the wrapping. For a limited time, you can save up to $48 on Osea sets, plus get free shipping. That's Mother's Day made easy. Pamper the moms in your life and get 10% off your first order site-wide with code MOM at OseaMalibu.com. That's OseaMalibu.com, code MOM.
One step up at number 11, the brilliant new song from Madonna from the album Erotica, Bad Girl.
We've done Madonna 8 fucking times on chart music. And this, her 34th single, is the follow-up to Deeper and Deeper, which got to number 6 last December. It's the 3rd cut from her 5th LP, Erotica, an album and an era where Madonna uncharacteristically did a sex, publishing a slab of Coffeytail Pondscrot at the same time, which sold 1.5 million copies in the first month at $50 a go. But 1993 has started badly for her, with her latest film Body of Evidence getting coated down across the world, and she's not enjoying the current film she's working on, Dangerous Game. Meanwhile, this single is a new entry at number 11 this week, so here's a clip of the video, which features her as an entrepreneur called Louise Oriol, who cops off with loads of blokes, with Christopher Walker being roped in one way or another, I don't know. So, yeah, it's been a while, hasn't it, since we've done Madonna?
So to speak.
And thus far in her career, Madonna's been a post-disco party girl, a vixstress, Marilyn Monroe, a pregnant teenager, some sort of flamenco dancer, Dick Tracy's girlfriend, Black Jesus's girlfriend, a bollock naked hitchhiker, and now she appears to be a dead body.
What a great, I'm sorry, that how can, you can't read that and just go, what a great CV. She's only 10 years into her career.
Yes.
There is a reason why Madonna has been on like every other episode of this podcast. It's because she put herself there. She put herself at the centre of pop culture and the pop charts and just stayed there for decades like no one else has done. So, you know, I'm afraid that's what you get being alive at this time, it's Madonna's time, and the gases will never converge in this way again in the universe. So, you know, you might as well enjoy it. You might as well enjoy it.
I know. We might as well call this the Madonna and Shaking Stevens podcast, and I've done with it.
And Depeche Mode. Yeah.
Oh, God, imagine if them two had done a fucking single together. Imagine if Madonna had done a Rocking Good Way instead of Bonnie Tyler. Fucking hell.
Yeah.
The universe had fucking collapsed in on itself.
I had this album on cassette, obviously, and I loved it, and I like a lot of her ballads, to be honest, which is, this is like the type C Madonna song. It's quite nothingy, but it's moody. It's got an evocative sound palette. It's very nicely produced. The video is quite a ravishing little mini movie directed by David Fincher.
Indeed.
After Mark Romanek, who's done everything else in this episode. He passed on it because he was busy doing something else. And it's Christopher Walken. This is one of only two videos that Christopher Walken has ever done.
That's right.
And the other one being Weapon of Choice by Fatboy Slim, which is a video. It's the best thing Fatboy Slim ever did, but the video is so much better than the song. It's actually fun to put the video on and just put other stuff to it and just see Christopher Walken dancing to anything else you can think of.
Yeah.
By this time, Madonna could have just done a video dressed up as a giant fanny with arms and legs, and you know, by 1993, people
have
just
peaches, basically.
Oh yeah, yeah,
yeah, peaches. Yeah, yeah.
You know, and people have just shrugged because it's not that people seem to be bored with Madonna by 1993. This is her 10th top 10 hit so far in this decade, and we're only 27 months into it. But no one's capable of being shocked by Madonna anymore. You know, that's who she is. This is what she does. It's successful. Good for her.
Yeah.
There's a really good article in The Atlantic that I read recently by Sophie Gilbert called What Madonna Knows, and it explains better than I can how Madonna's entire everything is essentially performance art, and Cyndi Lauper clocked this after the MTV Music Awards, where she sort of put on a wedding dress and showed her pants to the world, and everyone was scandalized, and Cyndi Lauper went, I know what she's doing.
Yeah.
And that's what she's always done. She's very, very good at it.
Yeah, and the video is directed by David Fincher, who got his start as assistant cameraman on Return of the Jedi and Indiana Jones and the Temple of Doom. Then he did the usual route. He did a load of adverts. Then he got into promo videos, which are just longer adverts with a bit of music. He did We Don't Have To for Jermaine Stewart, Englishman in New York for Sting, Straight Up for Paula Abdul, and then he linked up with Madonna to do Express Yourself and Vogue. He stepped back from videos over the past 2 years in order to direct his first film, Alien 3, but fell back into it for Who Is It by Michael Jackson. And the video is essentially Madonna as a sort of high-powered female executive of the early 90s that you usually see pouring blue water on a pad with a dry weave top sheet. And she's going about a business of copping off with the sorts of blokes in diners and bars, punctuated by shots of her washing her drawers in the sink and licking cat food off her finger. And Christopher Walken just hangs about and watches on until, as they used to say, it was murder.
It seems like a waste of Walken.
Yeah.
It's a waste of Walken because he's not doing a funny dance.
No.
And nor is he telling a small child about having a wristwatch hidden up his arse, you know. And that's kind of what we want from him.
Yeah.
He looks great, though. Can I just point out, he looks amazing. He's just smouldering away in a big black coat. He's apparently supposed to be a guardian angel, which is, he's not a very good guardian angel. You know, he's not doing his job very well.
Oh, no. Shit one. Yeah,
well, exactly. I assume that he was a guardian angel as well, but you know, because he hangs about on ledges and whatnot, reading the paper about a murderer and all this kind of stuff. But right at the end, just before her last cop off comes back from washing his dick in the sink or whatever he's up to, Christopher Walken appears and kisses Madonna, and you think, oh, hang on a minute, you're actually the Grim Reaper, aren't you? Because right at the end, we see both of them up in a crane watching the coppers taking the body away, and Madonna doesn't seem to be that arse about being murdered. She's accepted it.
She's going to heaven with Christopher Walken.
Yeah,
you know.
Fair dues.
Come on. Wouldn't any of us be all right with being grim reaped by Christopher Walken?
Did you pause and zoom in on the newspaper that he reads? It's the New York Post.
Tell me more, Simon.
I did. It's tantalising because I couldn't get all of it. I think the main headline is Bloody Carnage or something like that. It's bloody something. But in the sort of subheading, it says Cape 18, chops hands off dad, and then something something parakeet, maybe feeds to parakeet.
Oh, brilliant.
Yeah.
Would parakeets want to eat people's hands, though?
Probably.
Don't they tend to like nuts or something? Or a cracker?
If it's in a cage, it's got to eat what it's given. And if that's, you know, Cape Dad's hand, then so be it.
Yeah.
I know it's sort of nominally set in the present tense, but I thought the way that she's styled is actually quite kind of 1940s film noir. And it's not the first time she's done that, which is sort of stepping back from the sort of sexy Madonna thing. Well, it's a different type of sexy, but she looks a bit kind of like something out of a Raymond Chandler or Mickey Spillane novel. She looks like she'll be called a broad or a dame, you know, in this. I thought.
Yeah.
The song, though, you know, like many of Madonna's 90s hits, I've honestly never heard this before in my life.
And yeah, no.
I feel a bit gaslit by the claim that it even exists. And I had a look, because when we've talked about Madonna's 90s hits before...
Like you said, Simon, it's a proper pointless question, isn't it?
Oh, yeah, very much. Yeah, yeah, it is. And leaving aside cover versions like Don't Cry For Me, Argentina, if we look at her actual own sort of hit singles, from the one prior to this, which is Deeper and Deeper, which I couldn't sing with a gun to my head, right through to Frozen in 1998, which I vaguely remember, and then Ray of Light comes after that, and then I know that, obviously. But there are 5 years of consistent hits, particularly in the UK, you know, some of them top 10. No idea. It's really weird. Really odd.
Yeah, you were just, you know, into other stuff.
Yeah.
It's like, you know, I think much as Madonna is omnipresent, it is also possible if you try really hard to ignore her. So,
Well, I'll be honest, I can't stand Madonna. I really fucking can't stand Madonna. So, yeah, if I could ignore her, I would. So that kind of goes some way to explaining it. Yeah.
So the following week, Bad Girl nudged up one place to number 10, its highest position. However, in America, it only got to number 36 on the Billboard chart, the first Madonna single not to make the American top 20 since Holiday in 1983. Fucking hell, what a run. The follow-up, a cover of Fever, entered the chart at number 6 in April but got no higher, and she had one last squeeze of the Erotica teabag when Rain got to number 7 for 2 weeks in July. She then spent the rest of 1993 ripping up a photo of Joey Buttafuoco, who was famous in America at the time because his wife shot his 17-year-old lover in the face while having a bum sex-related surname on Saturday Night Live in a piss take of Sinead O'Connor, and then rubbing the flag of Puerto Rico against her fan air at a concert.
Oh, no. Oh, no.
The thing with Madonna is, yeah, I can't stand her, but I feel weirdly protective towards her at the moment because she's getting so much shit at the moment for being an older woman who has, A, had cosmetic surgery, and B, is still, you know, prancing about on stage and being sexy.
Yeah.
And all the criticism I see her getting, I think, fuck off, you know. I almost find myself becoming a fucking Madonna fan just to spite them. Do you know what I mean?
Well, you don't have to do that, but it is, like, in some ways, like, this is what Madonna has always done. Is she's a genuine provocateur and she's always sought to push people's buttons. And in some ways, this is, I'm sure it's hard for her. She's a human being, but also she is well versed in pissing people off and responding to the atmosphere that, but she pisses everyone off. It's like there are young people on TikTok going, oh, Nana's got out again. And like people have been doing that since she was 30.
Yeah.
You know? So like she's been well prepared for ageism. I'm sure, yeah, like I said, I'm sure it's incredibly difficult. But yeah, you do feel protective of her because she is daring to still be Madonna in the way that she always has and putting herself into the public consciousness. And I don't think it is that it's just she's desperate and she wants to cling to her youth or anything like that, because that's not her deal. I think it's, in some ways, it's an opportunity for her.
Yeah.
It's an opportunity to provoke people. All you have to do as an older woman is exist and be in public, and people are going to have fucking opinions about it. So, and she's always loved to. It's like, yeah, give me all your opinions, motherfuckers.
Yeah.
So I think she's okay. And it is inspiring, to be honest, as, you know, someone, she has been massive for about as long as I've been alive, or as long as I've been listening to pop music.
Yeah.
And I have no intention of kind of cavorting around in the Madonna fashion as I age. But
well, there goes the next chart music live then.
Well, I could be persuaded, you know, but it is bracing and bolstering to see her as she is doing what she does now. Mm. So I'm about a year younger than she was when she did Hung Up.
Right.
Oh, yeah.
You know, in her pink leotard and looking, as that Atlantic article says, as sinewy as a gazelle.
Right.
Looking incredible. And just the sheer force of will and defiance that it has taken for Madonna to create herself and sustain herself. Mm. It's just, I don't know, it's something to look to as a woman. And I don't think she did it for anyone but herself, but she's not just a complete need monster. It's not just, you know, she kind of, she works in mysterious ways, you know, and I'm glad of it. I'm glad that she's still around and doing what she does.
But rubbing the flag of Puerto Rico against your fanny, that's not on.
You know, it's hard to believe I introduced Diana Ross live on this programme almost 18 months ago, and I'm extremely proud to do it again with the new song, Heart Don't Change My Mind.
We said we'd try again, but trying's not enough.
You know, it's hard to believe I introduced Diana Ross live on this programme 18 months ago, says Franklin.
Cool story, bro.
Yeah.
That's your fucking job, mate. It's like your fucking bin man saying, oh, it's hard to believe I pushed this garden waste wheelie bin a fortnight ago and here I am again.
Oh, poor little Mark. No, but he's, to be fair to him, 18 months ago he was 12.
Yeah.
This is like a formative memory for him.
He then goes on about how proud he is to introduce her again. It's Diana Ross with Heart Don't Change My Mind. We've covered Diana Ross a time or two in chart music, most recently in chart music number 18, when she took Love Hangover to number 10 in May of 1976. Since then, she left Motown, went all post-disco with Nile Rodgers, tried to shove Mary Wilson off the stage at the Motown 25th anniversary TV special, sonically copped off with Lionel Richie, sweated for a bit in the gym, linked up with the Bee Gees for her first number one in 15 years, faded out in the late 80s, then rejoined Motown, got on the Whitney train and roared back to number two on two non-consecutive weeks with When You Tell Me That You Love Me in December of 1991. This single, the follow-up to If We Hold On Together, which got to number 11 in January, is the eighth cuts from her LP, The Force Behind the Power, which came out 18 months ago. It's not in the charts yet, but no way is Stan Leopold turning down the opportunity to have the boss in his studio. And here she is. And let's get Diana out the way first, because she's the least interesting thing about this performance. Extremely shared up, I believe.
Mm.
Wearing a tight spandex all-in-one, adorned with a big chunky gold belt and topped with a leather jacket that's miles better than any of Run Rig's.
Mm.
I think the overall effect she's gone for here is Rose out of Keeping Up Appearances attending the local biker bash and pig roast.
She's got black gloves on as well, though. It's like a cross between Alvin Stardust and Mark Almond or something.
Yeah, yes. Little gloves, yeah, with like it, with, yeah, pearl trim. As it turns out, I had a jacket like that with its own belt. It was brilliant. I did not, though, have a sort of bustier top with net décolletage.
Yeah.
It's a sexy get-up, isn't it?
Mm.
And what would now be known as treggings, I guess.
Treggings.
Trouser leggings.
Yeah, they're kind of wet look, aren't they? Yeah. So that it's that which is you know, very prevalent now, but you didn't see so much in those days. Mm. She was ahead of the curve. Mm. Yeah.
I watched it again last night, and it's like, hang on a minute, is she miming?
Oh, God.
That's against the rules.
Would Stanley allow this?
I think he'd make an exception for Diana Ross.
Yeah. I mean, just the whole setup is very unreal, isn't it? That she's in this kind of fake, almost Sesame Street-style cityscape where you've got a walk, don't walk sign, you've got a lamppost.
Yeah, a working walk, don't walk sign. It's a pretend New York street corner, isn't it? It's quite elaborate.
Yeah. You've got one of those blue bin things for getting a newspaper out of that they have in America. You know those ones.
Are you sure it's that? I thought it was an American post box.
Oh, is it a post box?
I thought it was a post
box. Oh, maybe. Yeah. And there's a fire hydrant, definitely, you know.
Yeah. There's a manhole cover with all dry ice coming out of it.
Yeah, that's what you want.
But what it made me think of was, and I'm sure this was not a deliberate reference on Diana's part, but do you guys know the book Rock Dreams?
Yes. Guy Pillet.
Yeah, yeah, it's Guy Pillet, or probably, yes.
Oh, fucking hell. Sorry, Guy.
Yeah, well, he's dead now. You can say what you want. So for those who don't know, he was the artist who usually used airbrush, who was responsible for example, The Sleeve of Diamond Dogs by David Bowie. So I'm sure everyone can sort of visualise his style from that. And this book, Rock Dreams, it's just a magical thing. It's from about 73, I guess, that kind of era. And it involved the journalist Nick Cohn writing little kind of paragraphs about rock legends, rock icons, and these kind of imagined scenarios that Pillet has painted of them. So, for example, you've got the Rolling Stones several times, you know, on one occasion they're dressed up as Nazis, another time they're sort of fetish transvestites and stuff like that. You've got Bob Dylan in the back of a limo looking troubled and all this kind of business. You've got Sam Cooke's dead body on the motel room floor. Diana Ross appears in it twice. The first time it's the Supremes, and what we see is an actual streetscape, which reminded me a little bit of this. It's got, you know, a sort of 1950s looking car, or 60s I suppose it would have to be, with a massive poster of the Supremes on the wall of what looks like a very down at heel neighbourhood. And it's really sort of flagging up the idea that the Supremes came from a kind of down at heel Detroit neighbourhood, and they are now very much living the glitzy high life. And then a few pages later, we see Diana, and she's solo, and she's sat in the back of a limo with loads of jewellery on and a fur stole wrapped around her neck, looking really traumatised and frightened as she looks through the window and sees a bunch of presumably homeless guys stood outside on a litter-blown street. And the text from Cohn says, "No cause for alarm, even now, after all these years. Great ladies of the music scene came back and cruised the streets and gazed into tenements and floated off down alleys just to check nothing had changed, .. And it's just a really wonderful, evocative picture of this incredibly successful and wealthy woman just looking with kind of horror at what her life used to be. Maybe it's a stretch, but when I saw the sort of fake rough streetscape on this performance, I thought of Rock Dreams.
Yeah.
The thing with Diana is, and we've done the mortality maths with Madonna already, Diana is 48 here, which is, you know, considerably younger than I am now. I just remember at the time, and I'm sure this isn't false memory, thinking, oh, who's this old granny on top of the pot? What's she doing there? Which, you know, obviously those opinions come back to haunt you. I don't know that I said so in print, but that is certainly what would have been going through my mind. So I thought I'd have a look to see who is 48 now.
Yes.
Just for comparison. And I know we're in a different world where you're allowed to stay young for longer. But okay, so here we go. Melanie Blatt and Shaznay Lewis, of All Saints, are both 48. Will.i.am and Fergie out of Black Eyed Peas. Lauryn Hill, Scary Spice, CeeLo Green, Enrique Iglesias, Natalie Imbruglia, Katie Tunstall, Jack White, Marion Cotillard, Lisa Scott Lee, Sia, Ant McPartlin, Ronnie O'Sullivan, Big Boy, 50 Cent, Gary Neville, Juninho, David Beckham, and Robbie Fowler. So those are all 48-year-olds now, which, okay, they're people of a certain age, but you don't think if one of them turned up on Top of the Pops. Well, if Ronnie O'Sullivan did, you'd be surprised.
Yes.
But you know what I mean? It's that age doesn't seem as completely over the hill as it did then.
No, and it's partly because of people like Diana Ross and, as well as Madonna and Tina Turner, who absolutely bossed that.
Yeah.
This is the designated heritage act, which starts to pop up on a regular basis on Top of the Pops round about this time, doesn't it? You know, last week it was Brian Ferrer. Next week it will be Cliff Richard. Essentially, you know, new singles by older artists that aren't in the charts yet, but are looking for something to be on now that Wogan's finished.
Yeah, exactly.
Something for the old ones, if you will.
I feel like this is quite similarly to Brian Ferrer.
Yeah.
For a lot of artists who were kind of transitioning from the 80s into the 90s, they're just kind of coasted.
Yeah, there's no need to try and be on the cutting edge anymore.
No, which, you know, which is fine, but also, Christ, I kind of suffered through this a bit. This is very, very 1988 as well.
Yes.
Like, who gives a shit? No one cares. Someone's going to buy it and keep her in diamonds, you know, and she's earned it, you know, fair enough, but nobody needs this in their life, do they?
But anyway, Sarah. Saxophone solo.
Saxophone solo.
Fuck me.
Yeah, in our chart music wiki, Pop Crazy Youngsters, there is an entire section entitled Sarah B's Search for the Last Great Sax Solo. Thanks to a request you made in Chart Music's Passim, and currently it only goes as far as The Best by Tina Turner in September of 1989. So I believe we have a new winner.
I don't know. I might endorse that as a fact, but I'm not happy about it.
Of course, the thing to say here is, of course, unless you know better.
Unless you know better.
Got a white bloke with his sleeves rolled up. A very Cronenberg advert, isn't it?
Oh, God, it's so funny. The way that this is edited is, you know, there's this kind of really grindy ballad going on. And, you know, it sounds like the big serious ballad in the middle of a regional theatre production of Puss in Boots, you know, where Puss has lost his boots. And she's there smiling away in a slightly incongruous fashion. And then suddenly there's a sax man. The way that it's just like, where did you come from, you stealthy sax man? He just suddenly appears. It's very much like the Saturday Night Live short, The Curse, from about 12 years ago. I don't know if you've seen this. It features John Hamm,
right,
who's best known from Mad Men, but is also a brilliant comic actor, as this oiled up sax man. Very much, he's obviously like Tim Capello, who was Tina Turner's sax man through the 80s and 90s, and also most notably the oiled up sax man from The Lost Boys.
Right.
He's the one true original oiled up sax man. Anyway, basically, Andy Samberg is going about his business, and wherever he goes, John Hamm will suddenly explode through a wall, oiled up with a saxophone, and looks at the camera and goes, "Sergio." Everywhere he goes, and he goes to his therapist, he's like, "Oh my God, I don't know what's, I think I'm going mad. Everywhere I go, this oiled up sexy sax man just bursts through the wall." And it's like, "Are you sure?" And then, of course, he bursts through the wall kind of on top of the therapist. It just gets worse and worse and worse until his wife actually gives birth to the full-sized oiled up sexy sax man, Sergio. It's very disturbing. Anyway, that's inevitably now what happens when I see Diana Ross get interrupted in, you know, what she was doing by his stealthy sax man.
She gets very excited by his arrival, doesn't she? She
gets a jacket off.
She gets a jacket off, throws it to the ground and starts spinning around and stuff.
Yes.
Which is really good stagecraft, but also, yeah, it doesn't really seem, doesn't seem warranted, does it?
He is a sexy sax man in a leather waistcoat. And I was kind of sceptical. And, I don't know if I'm a spoil sport for this, but I just thought, is he really a sax man?
Ooh.
Because he's just too buff. And I looked into it. And on the record, on the album, Force Behind the Power, the saxophonist is John Helliwell of Supertramp. Okay.
Right.
And I Google image searched John Helliwell of Supertramp.
Oiled up and muscular and Supertramp, they don't go together, do they?
John Helliwell looks, with the best will in the world, like a geography supply teacher, or, you know, basically a member of Supertramp.
Yes.
Right? So this guy, the sexy sax man on Top of the Pops, I'm watching his fingers, and I'm sceptical about him even being a saxophonist. He looks more like a hunk from Central Casting, whose next job is probably, you know, the Diet Coke ad where a load of office women look at him taking his top off on a construction site.
Yeah.
I think that's what it is. That's what's going on here.
Or on a scooter in a Gino Ginelli advert.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah.
I think Tim Capello actually kind of set the standard for the sexy sax man at this time. You know, people were just like, that's what you need. You know, you can't just have some schlub playing the saxophone. It's such a raucously bawdy instrument, you know, that you've got to get out the banana boat and get slippery. Just something else about Diana Ross here. Obviously, consummate performer and, you know, radiantly beautiful. But one of the things, I'm really sorry to say this, one of the things I didn't enjoy about this performance, I enjoyed how much she seemed to enjoy it and how together she is and how she knows completely what she's doing and what she wants to project. But there's this kind of extravagant graciousness about her, this kind of regal bearing that I find slightly overbearing, especially when it's such a nothing track.
Yeah.
It just doesn't really seem warranted. When you see Tina Turner, Tina Turner is this very kind of impressive, imperious presence, but then she's like, yeah, it's Tina time, get on down.
Yeah.
And this is very sort of removed and very sort of, it's the nature of the song, you know, it's only appropriate, but just her whole Diana Ross thing is sort of, you may worship me. And it's like, well, I have the utmost respect for Diana Ross, but I don't want to feel like I'm supposed to curtsy at this point. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Is that a terrible thing to say? I really do respect her extremely, and she's made some of the greatest records ever, but...
Absolutely. Yeah, I mean, it's remarkable. You know, someone who sings on some of my favourite records of the 60s, you know, The Happening, the 70s, Ain't No Mountain High Enough or Love Hangover, the 80s, Upside Down. But her appearance on this show just makes me go, when she turns up, you know. I suppose it's largely just the song. It is a nothing song, Heart Don't Change My Mind, written by Robbie Buchanan and Diane Warren. Diane Warren, of course, just wrote fucking everything, you know. Like, Nothing's Gonna Stop Us Now by Starship, Unbreak My Heart, Tony Braxton, Don't Wanna Miss a Thing by Aerosmith, you know, just those enormous songs. So, but it's just a really bog standard song about trying to summon up the resolve to leave someone. It makes no sense to stay, living my life in yesterday. I'm leaving, and I'm begging you. Heart, don't change my mind. Oh, heart, be strong this time, blah, blah, blah. Mm. Originally recorded by Streisand in 84. And, of course, Streisand was the absolute queen of grown-up divorce pop in that era. And, yeah, this is that. It's grown-up divorce pop. And I guess there's a demographic who want that with their Top of the Pops. Not me, not then, and not now. And, yeah, I just thought, bore off Diana Ross. And I felt weird for thinking that because she's done so much great stuff.
Yeah. Also, just the production of this track is so kind of sloppy, and she does have this slight edge to her voice, like a slightly reedy kind of edge, and it just cuts through too harshly. It's like a massive cleaver through a cheesecake, and there's like nothing underneath, so it doesn't display her ability to its best. It's like, this is not the best use.
There's no biscuit base.
There's no buttery biscuit base. It's kind of soggy cheesecake, you know.
Do you know, it's not even on her Wikipedia discography. If you go on there, this single, it's not there. Yeah, it's been written out of history, and maybe for the best. Yeah.
So the following week, Heart Don't Change My Mind entered the chart at number 31 and then dropped four places to number 35.
The UK's favourite 10, down a 10, E17 and deep. Down one at number 9, Depeche Mode, I Feel You. This week at number 8, falling 6, Take That, Why Can't I Wake Up With You? And at number 7, the highest new entry, Suede, Animal Nitrate. At number 6, down 2, Whitney Houston, I'm Every Woman. And at number 5, the brilliant Oh Carolina from Shaggy. At number 4, Lenny Kravitz, you saw him earlier, Are You Gonna Go My Way? And at number 3, Annie Lennox, double A-side, Little Bird and Love Song for a Vampire. At 2, Michael Jackson, Give In To Me. Which means still at number 1, Too Unlimited, This Is No Limit.
Franklin, still off camera, pitches straight into the top 10 with absolutely fuck all fanfare. And right at the other end comes this week's number 1, No Limit by Too Unlimited. Formed in Antwerp, Belgium by Jean-Paul Decosta and Phil Wilde in 1989, Biz Niz were a dance production duo who landed a UK hit when Don't Miss the Party Line got to number 7 for 2 weeks in April of 1990. In May of 1991, they worked up an instrumental dance track called Get Ready For This, which rocked the club scene of Peepooland but got no further. So, deciding they needed some rap on it, they called upon someone they'd already worked with on a business demo, the Amsterdam rapper Ray Schlingard, who was dividing his time between getting the party started and working as a chef at Schiphol Airport. They lobbed him a demo tape and told him to get on with it. When he returned his version, they were surprised that along with some rap, there was also some bird. Anita Doth, who was working as a secretary in an Amsterdam police station, possibly for Van der Valk. Da Costa and Wild were so delighted at what they heard, they decided to put them together and lo, Two Unlimited were born. Their debut single, Get Ready For This, was a continent-wide smash, spending two non-consecutive weeks at number two over here in October and November of 1991. They followed that up with another number two hit, Twilight Zone, in January of 1992, and a number four with Workaholic in May of 92. This single, the follow-up to Magic Friend, which got to number 11 in August of 1992, is the lead cut from their second LP, No Limits, which is due out in May. It was put out in the last week of January and immediately smashed into the chart as the highest new entry at number 4, then nipped up the following week to number 2, and a week later finally obliterated the 10-week reich of I Will Always Love You by Whitney fucking Houston. Yes! Yes!
Go on to Unlimited.
This is its fourth week atop the summit of, there aren't any mountains in Belgium or Holland, and since they've already appeared in the top of the pop studio three times already to do this song, it's finally time to get the video out. And panel, if we've done one thing on our chart music odyssey, it's giving thanks and praise and final rightful respect to the Belgians, don't you think? Two-man sound, Belgian world in action, making Moldy Old Dough a hit, Jacques Brel doing Terry Jacks a favour, and now this. And we haven't even got to Technotronic or Plastic Bertrand yet. Come on, Belgium.
Yeah, I was fully behind this, even though it doesn't seem like the kind of thing I would have been into at the time.
No.
And it caused all kinds of trouble. this sort of music was really becoming dominant in the charts at this time. And I kind of loved it. Or I loved a good old chunk of it. I think some of the greatest records of the 90s are Dreamer by Living Joy. You Sure Do by Strike. Or Baby D, Let Me Be Your Fantasy. And stuff that, you know. There's sort of one in my head. And anyway, never mind.
Another one. Can't you remember, Grandad?
It's got a sort of piano-y breakdown.
Well, that narrows it down a bit.
No, but this bit where it all stops for ages and it's all just like rain falling and this diva really going for it. And
right.
It's not Naked in the Rain.
No. Oh, Set You Free.
Set You Free. Yeah, it's Atlantic. Yeah.
Oh, okay.
And she's in the video. She's I don't know why I know from the chart show. Probably she's sticking out of the.
Isn't it Entrance?
Oh, is it?
I thought it was Entrance.
Yes, Entrance. No, you're right.
And Set You Free by Entrance. There you go.
So I've been in a fucking care home listening to your two. I'll expect David Van Day to pitch up any minute now.
Yeah, all of that. Yeah, yeah. It's all very sort of. Very kind of feather light, new disco, post rave kind of twinkly. Yeah, I love to hear those whenever they pop up. It always gives me a tingle.
I thought it was the glam rock of its day. I thought it was like, you know, these really brutal, simple terrace chants.
Yes.
That, you know, they weren't for music snobs, but they were really straight and to the point.
Yeah, very stompy.
Yeah, very stompy indeed.
But dainty with it, I think.
Yes.
So I lobbied to do a special edition of Melody Maker just about that. Yes. And Melody Maker, of course, was an indie rock magazine mainly. But I just thought we're a weekly paper and we are a music paper, and we have a certain duty to cover cultural phenomena. And I thought Euro disco or Euro pop, Euro dance, whatever you want to call it, was a really important 90s cultural phenomenon. So I kind of took control for one issue and I interviewed Two Unlimited. I also interviewed Culture Beat. Mr. Vane, that's a fucking banger. Come on. Yeah. And yeah, Culture Beat, I remember Culture Beat being really bemused when I started asking them any details at all about the music or the lyrics, because you know, they're like, well, we don't fucking know, you know.
Oh god, that's become a regular joke in our house, where if anybody wants something, it's I know what I want, and I want it now. I want food, because I'm Mr. Food. You can do it with anything, and it's so dumb and annoying. It's brilliant.
God, how was lockdown in your house? My God.
Yeah, it was brilliant. It was a hoot.
Yeah, so I interviewed Ray and Anita. Anita Delce, as she was known at that time. I don't know.
Right.
I don't know where Anita Doth comes from. I don't know which is the correct one. But I have seen both, but we called it Anita Delce, because I guess that's what it said in the press release that we were sent. I went to this really fucking bizarre event at, it was either Earl's Court or Olympia, one of those big ones. It was the Flora Aerobathon, sponsored by Flora Margarine. And there was a massive fucking...
Oh, was Terry Wogan there?
No, but there was... I see where you're going with that. There was a massive tub of margarine on the stage, like 20 feet wide and 8 feet tall. Just a giant fucking tub of margarine.
Did it have margarine in it?
I didn't get to climb over the edge and have a look. Everyone had to perform in front of it.
First rule of journalism is find out how much margarine's in a massive tub.
It was really odd. There were 20,000 people there. And they're all doing... Right. There was like... It wasn't Mr. Motivator. It was a fake Mr. Motivator. Shaking Motivator. Oh. Putting everyone through their paces.
Mr. Encourager.
Yeah, yeah. And every now and then, an actual pop star would... come on stage. So E17 were there doing whatever their new single, I guess, was it Steam? Steam. Or Deep?
Yeah,
Steam.
Or was it Deep?
Deep, yeah. So they were there.
You can rest upon my chest.
Yeah, yeah, maybe it was that. There were other people.
Oh, didn't they get
about...
in the tub? If they're E17 and you're doing that, man, the first thing you do is get in the tub of Flora and just start rubbing it into your chest. Being all homoerotic and suggestive.
Yeah.
Did a sexy sax man at some point burst out of it?
All covered.
Having gone in dry, you know.
See, this is why they needed you kind of stage managing it. But there were all these sort of second division celebs like Chris Quinton from Coronation Street hanging around, and Daniela Westbrook from EastEnders,
of course,
who was soon to get married to one of E17, I think, at that time. David Kidd Jensen was there.
Oh my god,
yeah, yeah,
bless
and,
him.
Page Three girl Suzanne Mitzi, remember her? And she was in a pop trio at that time called Rumour Has It. Really the strangest event I ever covered. But two are limited are there, and you know, it's all just in a day's work for them, and they're total pros. You know, they take it in their stride. Tom Sheehan, the legendary photographer who's just done all the sort of proper rock stars and everything, just comes along with me, and he's taking photos of Ray and Anita, and you know, she's sort of snarling and clawing at the air, and he's throwing sort of mean, sinister shapes and all of that. And fucking hell. I found them quite interesting to talk to, because, all right, they can't compete with David Yao for lyrical depth, but they were interesting people. That just their experience of what the fuck it's like being into Unlimited at that time was something that I wanted to find out about. We talked about stuff like the drugs laws in Amsterdam, because that's where they're from, you know, and all that kind of business. And I thought it was really worth doing.
Were you massively complimentary to them, Simon?
I think I had just the right amount of distance, but I fed them questions which allowed them to come out of it in a good light.
They should have called the article Flora and Fauna.
Oh, right, there we go.
See what I did there?
I see what he did there. Yeah, yeah. I mean,
wasn't it shit?
I think that's more of a subheading than a title. But in your workshop,
I can't sugarcoat it. I did have a massive crush on Anita, so you know, I wasn't going to be too mean. But I put it to them that, you know, there was this nickname they had, Too Untalented, that people hilariously used to say, and that there was this perception they're brainless puppets. And I found the interview, and Anita says, "Of course," I'm not going to say, "Of course." She says, "Of course," because it cannot be true that two people have so much success. Something must be wrong. Either we don't sing, or we've got masks on, or whatever. In fact, the producers write the music, we write the lyrics. It's 50-50. Now, you might think I've let them hang themselves, I've given them enough rope there, say that they write the lyrics. Like, come on, techno.
Yes.
But yeah, they basically faced snobbery from rockist types and from dance purists. They were getting it from both sides, really, shot by both sides. I thought No Limit, even though it's played to fucking death, it's an absolute absolute banger. You can't argue with it. It's just this kind of force of nature. And I thought Let the Beat Control Your Body was even better. That was just a fantastic track. I wondered what the great Simon Reynolds would have thought of this. So I went up into the attic earlier on today and fetched down his book Energy Flash, which is, you know, a history of dance music. And Simon, in that book, does make a case for kind of hooligan techno, almost just like really, really simple techno tracks with like a grinding riff that goes over and over and over and just grinds you into submission. And I thought that part of him might approve of Too Unlimited, but nah, they're barely a footnote in that book. So But one of the upshots of me interviewing them, first of all, there was a massive backlash on the capital B backlash pages of Melody Maker. That almost a whole week's worth of letters just slagging me off and slagging off the paper for doing all that stuff.
Yeah, it was safe to say that issue of Melody Maker didn't join the stack of all the other Melody Makers in the student bed seats of 1993.
Exactly. And within the paper, our dance music experts, Ben Turner and Push, really nice guys, and they basically ran the dance section at the back of the paper. They were really pissed off that the words, well, the word four times, techno, 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 had been put on the front of Melody Maker, emblazoned across a photo of Too Unlimited. Because to them, the word techno was something precious and, you know, important and intelligent and progressive. And they thought that Too Unlimited were not worthy of that word. So from then on, in the pages of Melody Maker, Ben and Push changed the spelling of techno, their type of techno, to T-E-K-N-O. Because they didn't want anything to do with it. I thought that was really funny, but bless them for that. This track, I think there's a little joke in there that's been lying dormant for years that no one's noticed. There's a bit where Ray goes, "Let me hear you say yeah." And you hear a crowd going, "No."
Yes.
I swear they're going, "No."
Really?
Yeah, they're not going, "Yeah."
Yeah, they go, "No."
That was just it's quite a distant sort of hiss of like, "Yeah."
Yeah.
I think they're just saying "yeah" in Dutch.
I've gone on about Too Unlimited too long. It's got to be your turn now.
Yeah, no such thing, Simon. Yeah. No such thing. I mean, I said earlier in this episode that I was hoovering up the local pirate stations at the time, but the minute they started playing proper techno, fucking radio's coming right off. I had no time for that bollocks. But this sort of thing, when it came out, it amused me. Because it was, it was clearly Glamboni-M.
Yeah.
And it pissed off no end of people. And the minute I heard it, I thought, well, this is going to be number one.
Yeah.
No fucking problem.
Yeah.
I mean, if I was 12 or something, I'd have a right old stomp around my bedroom to this.
It does kind of sound like kids' music superficially, but it's, you can't really write it off as a simplistic record for babies, you know, because it is more deceptively interesting. I mean, at the time, I have to admit that I found it annoying and stupid, but I have come to appreciate it. Mm. And I'm now very fond of it. I can't imagine any circumstances under which I'd actually put it on, but that's, you know, that's not the point. I was glad to see it here at number one. Musically, it's not really techno in any sense, but it doesn't matter. There's kind of an interesting thing happening because it is very but there's interesting stuff going on. In the first 32 bars, there's different synth patches playing the same hook. Mm. So it is actually more varied than it feels. It's like thing comes in, then does the same thing in a different way. That goes away. Different thing happens again. It's like they're swapping in and out different colour filters, which is quite unusual.
Yeah.
And there's also this, in the chorus, there's the kind of classic house drone in the background, which sounds quite like Open Your Mind by Yuzura, which is a track that gets played quite a lot in this house in various circumstances. And there's a sort of phantom bass line, like it doesn't really have a bass line, but you can sort of, you know, you put one in yourself. Mm. It sort of reads as a hymn to hedonism because of the musical context, because it's a dance track, and because of the delivery, because of like how powerful it is and how she's got this very soulful voice, which is being deployed to the same sort of effect that other people were doing at the time.
Yeah.
Basically, it's a song about achieving your true potential and powering through to greatness. And it had to get to number one to prove it was true. Mm. So it is, and I love it when this happens, it is a demonstration of the theory it advances.
Ooh, yes.
Or, of course, to Anita, who has survived cancer more than once, she now considers it's something that she loves because she feels it's about overcoming adversity. Oh, she said, you know, it's such an explosion of positivity and we are limitless beings.
They do what they want and they do it with pride.
Yeah.
Al, that was the last line of my article as well. It had to be, didn't it?
Of course.
They do what they want, and they do it with pride.
And what they want in this video is to be in a massive pinball table.
Yes.
Which looks mint.
Yeah, it's fucking brilliant.
Proper old school pinball table as well.
Yes. I think there is actually technically a limit to pinball, or that they will throw you out.
Pinball, man, I fucking loved it, because I worked in a student union, as I mentioned earlier.
And
on the second floor of the building, we had a RoboCop pinball machine, and we had Monday Night Football. And the first thing I'd do in the morning, I would go to the cafe, get a hummus and sweet corn bap, and forget about my office. Mm. I would just sit at those machines for about 2 hours, and if anybody needed me, they knew where they'd find me. I can still hear in my head, like, I'd buy that for a dollar and that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
Just the voice going over and over. But if there was a Two Unlimited actual pinball machine, fuck me.
Oh, fucking hell, yes.
Just like playing their songs over and over.
And when the ball goes down, it goes, tickle, 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 tickle.
Yeah, no. Yeah. If you fuck up, it goes, no.
Fucking hell, I miss pinball. Mm. I hate those new pinball tables you see in pubs that have made as small as possible. It's no.
What? No,
that's no fucking good. Oh. I'm depressed now.
Oh, but cheer up, Al, because Two Unlimited were so lovely in this
advert, weren't
they? They're so pretty, and they're being hard, but they're so adorable. Yeah.
And they're called Ray and Anita as well, man.
Yeah.
Which sounds like they should be on Opportunity Knocks in 1972.
Yeah.
Or Bullseye.
Or The Neighbours on the Other Side of George and Mildred.
Yeah, they should be like my dad's friends. Like, I say to my dad, oh, what'd you do last week? Yeah. Oh, yeah, we just went to have dinner with Ray and Anita, you know. Yeah.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, saw their holiday site.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah.
They've been to Gibraltar, you know.
There's some very good hand movements in this video.
Oh,
the absolute bare cheek of invoking no valley too deep, no mountain too high in the lyrics. That's next level. But yeah, so
Episode as Diana.
When just to emphasize this, no valley too deep, she points down, and then no mountain too high, points up, you see. And he does at some point, Ray, who is dressed in a very fetching combination of baggy PVC, which has now come back, actually.
Right.
Yeah. You're allowed to have baggy PVC once again. And he does a very good reprimanding finger wag to camera to indicate there are no limits. Yeah. No.
Yeah. He's got no top on under his leather coat, but he can get away with it, you know, so fair play. Yeah.
They're both very saucy, aren't they? But overall, there is something very sort of clean and innocent about it.
Yeah, it's wholesome.
Like, it's quite wholesome. It's not actually very drugs.
No.
I think, you know, they're probably being Dutch and being from Amsterdam, you know, they can choose to or not, and it's probably not such a big deal, you know.
It's like people who live in Blackpool never had a stick of one in their life. Yeah.
It's definitely more sentier than salvia, I think.
Anything else to say?
My interview was certainly kinder to them than the Chris Morris interview.
Oh, yes.
Have you heard that?
Oh, no.
Oh, my God. Right. So basically, if you haven't heard it, because I think Chris Morris was on Radio 1 at that time.
Yeah.
I think that must be how he had access to them. So they go in completely innocently, you know, they go in wholeheartedly thinking, oh, well, you know, this guy, Chris Morris, wants to interview us.
Our English friends want to talk to us.
Yeah, yeah. So they go in and he pretends that he thinks that There's No Limit, We Reach for the Sky is a tribute to Britain's World War II flying ace Douglas Bader, whose biography and a biopic was called Reach for the Sky. And he starts thanking them and congratulating them for that, and they are completely baffled. They don't know what he's talking about. And then he gets really offended, saying, that's so disrespectful. How do you not know who Douglas Bader is? I think you should apologise right now and dedicate it to him. And they're really flustered, and they go, there's no limit, we reach for the sky. That one's for you, Doug.
So No Limit would spend a fifth and final week at number one before being usurped by Oh Carolina by Shaggy, and would keep Why Can't I Wake Up With You by Take That and Give In To Me by Michael Jackson off number one. The follow-up, Tribal Dance, would spend 2 weeks at number four in May, and they'd go on to have eight more top 40 hits, three of which made the top 10. But when their five-year contract came up for renewal in 1996, Slingard and Doth had had enough and walked away. So DeCosta and Wild just recruited two more people and carried on regardless. By 2009, after doing PAs and student union performances separately, the original two decided to reunite under the name Ray and Anita. And then linked back up with DeCosta and were given their name back, which they've used to this day.
Oh, that's nice.
Although Anita stepped down again in 2016.
To Unlimited at number one. That's it for Top of the Pops this week. Join Tony Dalton next week when live in the studio we'll have Cliff Richard with his brand new song. Comic Relief, don't forget it is next Friday. Get your red nose. We'll see you here, Top of the Pops, next week. Good night.
And that, me dears, closes the book on this episode of Top of the Pops. What's on telly afterwards, you may ask? Well, BBC One kicks on with Michelle's daughter Vicky getting kidnapped outside her school in EastEnders. Then David Attenborough gets to see a gang of 60 chimpanzees hunting and killing smaller monkeys for their tea in Wildlife on One. Louisa Ricks and coffee wanker Gareth Hunt play mismatched neighbours in the sitcom Side by Side. Then it's the 9 o'clock news, the Lenny Henry sitcom Chef, Question Time, the American crime series Law and Order, Ramadan Call to Prayer, the weather, and then they close down at 5 past midnight. Ramadan Call to Prayer is a sort of Muslims talking about what Ramadan means to them and not a live broadcast from Mecca, although I wish the BBC had done that because that would have winded up some gammons. BBC Two has just started First Sight, which focuses on bullying in the office. Then Muriel Gray whoops it up in Jackson Hole, Wyoming, for the Ski Ponds programme, The Snow Show. Then it's Top Gear, followed by French and Saunders having a go at Guns N' Roses and Ingmar Bergman. The second part of A Labour of Love, the documentary series about childcare in the early 20th century. Staggering stories of Ferdinand de Burgos. Newsnight, The Late Show, The Weather, and a bit of Open University ramble. ITV showing that episode of 3D with the HIV-positive vicar, along with a piece on Emma McCune, the convent girl who married the leader of the Sudan People's Liberation Army. After the bill, Arthur Daly organises a football match with the local police in a bid to keep the Winchester Club open in Minder. Then it's Disguises, where Adam Holloway goes undercover to investigate care in the community. After news at 10 and regional news in your area, it's more snooker, The Equaliser and Nighttime. Prisoner Cell Block H and Casey Kasem, basically.
Right.
Channel 4 eventually comes out of Channel 4 News and goes into Close to Home, which is about how fucked off the people of North Wales are at English cunts coming over here with their funny smelling food and Morris dancing and all that. After The Secret Life Of looks at the word processor, it's the last in the series of Turning the Screws, the documentary series about life in Wandsworth Prison. That's followed by a team-building session in Drop the Dead Doncare, the new series Harry Enfield's Guide to Opera, a repeat of The Avengers, a repeat of Dispatches, and they finish off at 1 a.m. with a repeat of the Dick Powell Theatre. So, me dears, what are we talking about in the playground tomorrow?
This bit is always such a headbend, isn't it? Because is it you as you were in 1993, but somehow still at school, like an imaginary version of you as a 10-year-old, but cool? You now pretending to be young. I don't know. Me, as a small child, I'd be talking about rage because swears. And I bet a few kids actually got detention after this. And also Suede because fucking wow.
Yeah.
I'd just be talking about Suede, I think. The best band in the world. I'd just be thinking, fucking hell, yeah, the future is theirs. I was probably saying exactly that at the Melody Maker office.
What are we buying on Saturday?
Well, imaginary cool me, Suede, but uncool, more realistic me, Lenny Kravitz.
I guess I didn't really buy records in those days. I just phoned up and got them delivered for free.
Ah,
but yeah, I guess
Rage Against the Machine, Suede, and Two Unlimited. Yeah.
And what does this episode tell us about March of 1993?
The thing is with this question is I feel like I always want to answer the same, which is that there's always something, even if this is a kind of weird gutter in between the road of rave and the pavement of Britpop, there's always going to be something interesting, and Madonna.
What we're meant to say on any sort of documentary that you see these days is, well, Britpop was just around the corner and then the world changed and all that kind of thing.
Yeah.
And yeah, it kind of was, but Suede aren't number one. Suede are number fucking seven, you know, much as I love them. Number one is Two Unlimited.
Yeah.
You know, that's the real 90s. And people like Hadaway, What Is Love, you know, that's a bigger deal than anything Suede ever did. And I fucking adore Suede. So I do think this kind of rewriting of history that goes on. So, yeah, I think this episode of Top of the Pops tells us that the real 1993 was a lot more mixed than we are led to believe by historians.
Yeah, and not as shit as we were led to believe either.
Yeah.
You don't look at this and just think, oh, God, I hope Oasis and Blur turn up soon and sweep all this away.
No, not really. I suppose I was a bit frustrated by Ferry and Diana Ross turning up on what's meant to be a sort of young person's pop show.
Yeah.
Oh, and also fucking Right Said Fred and their horrible comic relief thing. That can absolutely get to fuck.
Yeah.
And don't think I forgot about you, Pudsey Bear, just because it's not Children in Need. I fucking hate Pudsey as well. You know, he can fuck right off.
And that, Pop Craze Youngsters, brings us to the end of another episode of Chart Music. All that remains for me to do now is pump out the usual promotional flange, www.chart-music.co.uk, facebook.com/chartmusicpodcast, reach out to us on Twitter @chartmusictotp, money down the G-string, patreon.com/chartmusic, tickets still available for our Chart Music All Day at Birmingham Town Hall, Saturday 13th of January 2024. Oh, it feels so funny saying that, 2024.
Yeah, exciting though. See you there. Yeah.
Thank you very much, Sarah B.
Cheers, lad.
God bless you, Simon Price.
Ah, bless you too.
My name's Al Needham, and I really hope you've been listening to a podcast about Top of the Pops and not accidentally listening to audio of me having a massive wank.
Chart Music.
Love hurts. Down 2 at 28 on the official countdown. This is Bruno. Stand by for another new entry. That's next. Rage Against the Machine. Killing in the Name is in at
number 27.
Rage Against the Machine, Killing in the Name. That's a new entry at 27.
Calling all pop craze youngsters. You asked for it. We were offered it. So we said, all right then, fuck it, why not? Saturday, January the 13th, 2024. Birmingham Town Hall, Chart Music Live all dayer. Yes, Pop Craze youngsters, Chart Music is getting on down to Benny Tan with the power trio of Simon Price, Neil Kulkarni and Al Needham for a full day of Chart Music ramble. We commence with the return of Here Comes Quizzem, the Chart Music pub quiz. And then a 3-hour live episode of Chart Music. And then we round off the evening with a Chart Music disco, where we dance the night away to the white-hot sounds of Joy Sarnie and Two Man Sound. It do be the complete Chart Music experience, Miss Diane, and can be yours for a mere £15. So, see that internet. mashup.bit.ly/CM24. That's bit.ly/CM24. Lay your money down and be prepared to be pop-crazed all day long in beautiful downtown Birmingham. Hey, piss troll, we're coming for you.
Selling a little or a lot? Shopify helps you do your thing however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage. All the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage. Shopify is there to help you grow. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout. 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Get a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/work. Shopify.com/work.